It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
We like fighting a woman.
What is with this company's obsession with ninjas?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster, who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
Welcome to episode 683 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for TLC Sunday, December 20th, 2020. I am the Solo Monster. Christmas is coming up. Christmas is less than a week away. Unfortunately, WWE left a lump of coal for the rest of us this past week, delivering another awful Raw, delivering another record low rating. And you're going to hear a lot of prognosticating. You're going to hear a lot of opining this week from different people about why, who, what, where, when, and how to fix the problem and how to address it, how to turn things around. And they're all wrong. And I'm going to tell you why they're wrong. And I'm going to tell you the one thing that needs to happen in order to stem the bleeding and to try to save Monday Night Raw, try to turn things around creatively in this company. One thing that needs to happen. And I'm going to tell you all what that is here today. Plus, we're going to go through TLC predictions. Now I've had the chance to watch Raw and SmackDown, so I've got a few more thoughts on that. We'll lead off with that. We've got some other news to get into. A lot of stuff to get into this week. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for choosing me for your pro wrestling coverage. And I do hope everybody has a great holiday coming up a little bit later on this week. I want to thank everybody who has picked up a free copy of the Young Bucks book on Audible or other books, whatever book you might be interested in. You can get one book for free when you use our link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. So keep using that link, right? The year's almost up. You guys can get in on that, start the free trial, and get yourself one free book that you get to keep no matter what. And I want to say thank you to all the people who have supported the show via PayPal this week. Going through our roll call here, got to start off with Max the Axe Velado. Thank you for the Christmas PayPal. Max dropped a holiday bomb on me this week, and that was very kind of him to do, so thank you to Max. Night Stalker, Naif Al-Safar, the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Killshot Keith Hart, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray. You may have heard me mention his name about 6 months ago. He and his wife, Carrie, got married. And now they just closed on their first home, which is very exciting. So congrats to the both of you. Maybe you can build me a little room out on the side. I don't need a lot of space. Just, you know, a place to set up my little podcasting studio. You know, maybe like an outhouse in the back or something. So congrats to Rob, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichert, Stephen Handyman Halistick, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Better Than Raw, Michael Michalshek, who would be hard not to be these days, Ostentatious Alan Carter, the Wichita Workhorse, Clayton Nettleton, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto. I want to send a very special happy birthday shout out to Tabitha. I met Tabitha on the Jericho Cruise earlier this year. Feels like a lifetime ago now. And it is her birthday today. So I hope it is a good one. And I hope that you enjoy the podcast today. And shout out to guitar hero John Kiernan, who has been working on theme songs for independent professional wrestlers now for quite some time. The clip that you are about to hear is from a new entrance theme that he helped compose for PJ Black, which is called You Will Believe in Me, featuring Monster Tarver, the former Michael Tarver, Black's old running partner in the Nexus. Remember Justin Gabriel, Michael Tarver? Now they're working together. Now you're putting them together here musically. And also Kevin from It Lives, It Breathes, which is Will Ospreay's theme. Again, it's called You Will Believe in Me. Here's a clip.
Deepest
song is live right now on Spotify, Apple Music, and YouTube. Again, it's called You Will Believe in Me. Just search for the name John Kiernan, K-I-E-R-N-A-N. And you can find more of his wrestling themes on youtube.com/John Kiernan Music. So we've got some more shout-outs coming up here in a bit after I get through these TLC predictions. I got my predictions up on Thursday night on the YouTube channel. But now having watched Raw and SmackDown, I've got a few more thoughts to fill in here. And then I'm going to have a lot to say about Vince McMahon. You are not going to want to miss that, so stay tuned for that. But WWE TLC takes place tonight, the final WWE pay-per-view of the year. Tonight is also the WrestleRumble.com Deck the Halls contest, where we are giving away, well, WrestleRumble is giving away. I got to give all the credit to WrestleRumble here. They're the ones with all the belts ready to be shipped out. I'm just the one delivering the good news to five lucky random winners that will be selected tonight. During the YouTube stream, I'm going to be live after TLC, and that is where we will announce the winners. It's only $1 to enter. You can enter as many times as you like. There's no limit on that. Picking five winners. Fifth place is the Triple H Signature Series belt. Fourth place is the Edge Rated R Spinner belt. Third place is the Brahma Bull belt. Second place is the Smoking Skull belt. And the first place winner will receive an Eddie Guerrero Signature Series Championship belt replica, which is the old Undisputed title. A design that he won at No Way Out in 2004, but with a special design on the strap to match his ring gear that he wore that night for the match where he beat Brock Lesnar. This is pretty badass. So again, I'll be choosing the winners at random tonight. You have until 7 o'clock, 7 p.m. Eastern, right when the pay-per-view kicks off. That is the deadline to enter. Just go to WrestleRumble.com. We've got the New Day defending the Raw Tag Team titles tonight against Shelton Benjamin and Cedric Alexander of The Hurt Business. The New Day has a pair of wins already on TV over The Hurt Business. Cedric Alexander has a pair of wins himself over the individual members of The New Day. He's got singles wins over Kofi Kingston and Xavier Woods. And it just feels like the right time to make the change. I mean, to put these two teams together for a third time and have New Day go over would basically just kill the Hurt Business as credible contenders, and I don't know why you would do that. Hurt Business has been one of the more enjoyable things on Raw all year long. So I'm picking the Hurt Business to go over here. Yeah, they've had their issues with Jeff Hardy and Matt Riddle, and so it would make sense to see the Hurt Business go over, win the titles, and then enter into a feud or a match with Matt and Jeff. The Hardy Bros. Sasha Banks will defend her SmackDown Women's Championship for the second time against Carmella. This is coming off their title match on SmackDown 2 weeks ago, where Sasha was disqualified for refusing to stop kicking ass. Carmella broke a bottle of champagne across Sasha's back after the match. Not once, but twice. She did it again on Friday. For the second time, broke a bottle of bubbly over Sasha's back. Sasha Banks should not be dropping this title before WrestleMania 37. And the match at WrestleMania should be Bianca Belair against Sasha Banks. Whether Sasha wins that, whether Sasha loses that, and Bianca goes over, either way, that is the match that they should be building up to. It's a match that we've never seen before. I think it has the potential to be a damn good match. Bianca Belair is a star on the rise in that women's division. And I don't see any reason to interrupt Sasha's title reign. Sasha Banks had plenty of title reigns interrupted. In fact, every single title reign she had up to this point, previous to this, she didn't hold on to that title for very long. She was finally able to get that albatross off from her neck and prove that she can not only win the title, but retain and hold on to it. And now, I think she ought to hold on to it until the right time, and the right time might be WrestleMania, but it sure as hell ain't TLC. Carmella in this character, she plays it well. I'm not even saying Carmella is bad, but Carmella is not the right choice right now to be the women's champion. So I am going with Sasha to retain. And by the way, on SmackDown this week, we had Bianca losing to Bayley, which is fine because that was the first of what I'm sure will be multiple matches between the two of them. Some people were freaking out about that, and again, not a big deal. I expected Bayley to win the first match when they met up, but it's exactly what I had pitched. The first opponent for Bianca Belair coming out of Survivor Series should be Bayley. In fact, before we even knew Bayley was going to be on her team, I said, put Bayley on the team. Start building tension between the two of them, because when Bianca eventually gets that win, Bayley is the most credible person outside of the champion that she could beat. Right? Bayley was the longest reigning SmackDown champion of all time. So that was the first of what I'm sure will be multiple matches we see between them. Bianca would be my choice to win the Women's Royal Rumble match. So I have a very clear picture in my brain of how this progresses to get to WrestleMania. Randy Orton takes on The Fiend, Bray Wyatt. Two men with a history together that dates back 4 years. Orton was a member of the Wyatt family, then he burned down the Wyatt family compound, then he beat Bray for the WWE title in a terrible match at WrestleMania 33. And then came the House of Horrors match at Payback. And I said this on Thursday. I feel like I'm one of the few people who actually enjoyed at least the cinematic portion before they came back to the arena of that match 3 years ago. Almost 4 years ago, actually. It was April of 2017. So we're actually going on closer to 4 years than we are three. If this was going to be a straight wrestling match, I wouldn't really have high hopes for this, but they have announced a new stipulation. This is going to be the first ever Firefly Inferno match. And this comes after the angle they shot on Monday night where Randy Orton wanted to play hide and seek with Bray Wyatt. And when he found him, he beat him up. He stuffed him into a large crate and he doused it in gasoline. He set the crate ablaze. He set it on fire. And then out from the crate popped not Bray Wyatt, but The Fiend, who, for the second time, put Orton in the mandible claw and put him down. And so now we are getting a Firefly Inferno match. They have not explained the rules or the format of the match. I am led to believe it is going to be a cinematic match that may have already been taped. I don't see this being a traditional Inferno match. I mean, traditional Inferno match would be the winner has to be burned. I don't even mean that. Last Inferno match we saw was a Ring of Fire match with Bray Wyatt and Kane. And you could pin your opponent, make them submit. It wasn't about burning them. It was about keeping people like the Wyatt family outside of the ring. Is it that kind of match? Again, I feel like it's going to be cinematic. I feel cinematic is the best way to go. That's how this match should be. To me, it gives it a fighting chance of being interesting. Alexa Bliss has not been on TV now for the past 2 weeks. Apparently, she had some pre-scheduled time off with her fiancé. I don't know if she's expected back for the pay-per-view tonight. I hope so. Or maybe if the match was already taped, maybe she's already, you know, her part was already filmed. But she has been the most interesting part of this entire storyline, Fiend character. I think she's played her role just perfectly. And it would be a little bit strange for her not to be involved in this in some way. So hopefully, you know, we'll see her in there. In some way, but you know, it's been a very up and down year for The Fiend. Highest of highs from being the Universal Champion to the lowest of lows, the way he lost to Bill Goldberg in Saudi Arabia, winning the title back and dropping it a week later to Roman Reigns. It's been a very up and down year. I think the year, for his sake, will end on a higher note. It'll end with a win. I am predicting a win over Randy Orton here in this match. We have Nia Jax and Shayna Baszler defending their WWE Women's Tag Team titles. They were originally supposed to defend them against Asuka and Lana. And Lana beat Nia Jax on Raw Monday night. She paid the price for it. She and Shayna Baszler injured Lana when the match was over. They injured her ankle or her leg, rendering her unable to compete. She is not cleared to wrestle. She is not expected to be on the show. I don't think it's all just one big swerve where she limps her way to the ring and then miraculously they end up winning the tag team titles. So they are billing a mystery partner. Asuka is going to have to find herself a mystery partner to compete for the tag team titles tonight. Peyton Royce went on Twitter on Thursday and offered her services and said, "Hey, Asuka, I could be your partner." But I think the mystery partner ends up being Charlotte Flair. We have not seen Charlotte Flair on television since June 22nd. And on that edition of Raw, on June 22nd, the person that Charlotte Flair was fighting with and brawling with and was injured by was Nia Jax. So wouldn't it be appropriate for her to make her return in a match where she's going after Nia Jax for revenge and trying to take her title away from her? And so if it ends up being Charlotte and Asuka, then I predict a title change. I think they win the women's tag team titles. If it is anybody else, if it is Peyton Royce or just somebody else they stick in there, then I see a Nia and a Shayna retention here in this match. But if it is Charlotte Flair, and I'll even throw Lana's name in there, if it is one big swerve and Lana ends up limping on out to the ring, then I think we still see a title change there too. Charlotte or Lana, we've got new champions. Anybody else? Nia and Shayna retain. We've got Roman Reigns, the tribal chief, defending his universal title in a tables, ladders, and chairs match against Kevin Owens. And when Kevin Owens got drafted from SmackDown to Raw last year, he said that he was hoping for a fresh start. He had sort of fallen through the cracks. They weren't really doing a whole lot with him. He was hoping for just sometimes a change of scenery. You look in sports, like baseball players. I mean, sometimes you could be playing so poorly on one team in one city in one stadium, and then you get traded, and it's almost like you have a new lease on life, and you're playing like a totally different person. And Owens was hoping for a change of scenery, being just what the doctor ordered. And he had that feud with Seth Rollins and the big dive off the WrestleMania sign at the Performance Center, but largely his run on Raw was a bust. So when he got drafted back to SmackDown a few months ago, he told Bleacher Report the same thing. I was hoping that it would be a good, you know, a nice restart, a fresh start for me. It seems like we're always talking about Kevin Owens hoping for a fresh start. I don't think he is fully appreciated for all that he brings to WWE. And frankly, I think he's even more valuable to them as a heel. Just better. Just more natural at it than he is a babyface. But they already have a heel, top heel on SmackDown. His name is Roman Reigns. And as long as he's going to be reigning, no pun intended, on top as the champion, they really don't have room for another sort of 1B. Or if you want to look at the one and two heel. Because Roman is not dropping that title anytime soon. Roman needs baby faces to get in the ring with, and Kevin Owens is the flavor of the month. Don't see him winning the championship, but he's a good person to put in there and fill that gap, at least for one pay-per-view, which I think is all that it's going to end up being, against Roman Reigns. So unfortunately for him, unfortunately for KO, yeah, he's in the main event, or one of the main events, but I don't see there being much of a chance of there being a title change here. I think it's obvious Jey Uso will be involved in some way. I'll throw the name Jimmy Uso out there and say that we see Jimmy Uso back on the show tonight as well, helping out Roman Reigns defeat Kevin Owens, and now we complete the Samoan Bloodline faction. And on TV every week, it'll be Roman Reigns with both of the Usos. So that is my prediction for tonight. Roman Reigns is going to WrestleMania. Roman Reigns may go beyond WrestleMania as the Universal Champion, but he, like Sasha Banks, should not be losing his championship before WrestleMania. And we have Drew McIntyre defending the WWE title in a TLC match against AJ Styles on Raw Monday night. They tried to get AJ over as a more of a serious threat than I think they've made the attempt to make him out to be every other week up to this point. They've been doing a lot of comedy with him and almost, and he's really been playing up the whole, you know, chicken shit heel type thing, and not to the degree that Miz and Morrison do it, but they tried on Monday night. They had he and his bodyguard leave Sheamus for dead, Drew's best friend. End of the show, he ends up putting Drew through a table, you know, coming off of a ladder. They had this championship ascension ceremony with both guys in the ring cutting a promo and ladders in the background and stuff. And so that is the final image that they left you with. AJ Styles standing tall with the WWE title. There is the wild card, of course, of The Miz, who has the Money in the Bank briefcase. Is The Miz going to attempt to cash in tonight or not? I thought for sure he would at least try to at Survivor Series, and that did not happen. That would have been 10 years to the day that he cashed in Money in the Bank the first time and became the champion. Now, Miz and Morrison beat Keith Lee in a handicap match on Monday night, which sucks for Keith Lee, because we've seen Miz and Morrison lose to other people in handicap matches, but Keith Lee couldn't get the job done. I would like to think that as angry as Keith Lee looked at the end of that match when it was over, that if Miz and Morrison try to get involved and Miz tries to cash in tonight, Keith Lee is going to be there to stop them. Keith Lee is going to be there to destroy them and get them out of the picture. And when AJ's bodyguard, who's like 20 feet tall, tries to literally elevate him up to the championship and help him win, we'll see Sheamus, we'll see Drew's best friend come out and try to get some revenge for what they did to him on Monday night. And in the end result is Drew McIntyre retains and remains the WWE champion. Drew just won the belt back about a month ago. He already lost it once. He just got the belt back. I would not take the title off him now, this quickly after he just got it back. Although with his ratings stuff, with the ratings bottoming out, all cards are on the table. There's no telling what they're liable to do tonight. There's no telling what they're liable to do on TV tomorrow night. In terms of doing a big title change to shock people, having Miz cash in, I think, frankly, now, everything is sort of up in the air. They may be in panic mode. They may want to try to make a move to try to, you know, get some buzz going and stir things up a little bit. But I don't see Drew losing the title tonight. Don't see that happening. So that's your money in, that Money in the Bank. I just talked about Miz being Mr. Money in the Bank. That's your TLC cut. They're so interchangeable, right? Ladders and tables, it's all the same shit. But TLC is tonight. When the pay-per-view is over, join me live on YouTube. I will be going live with a full recap of the show and picking 5 different winners. 5 people are getting replica belts tonight. It could be you. That Eddie Guerrero belt is sick. Gotta take a look at that. It's actually pretty cool. So again, head on over to WrestleRumble.com and deck the halls. Couple of more quick shout-outs here. Masgrave Micah Harshaw. I mentioned Micah last week. He has been a listener of the podcast for many years. He has been running a small Mexican restaurant in downtown Indianapolis called the Tamale Place for several years. And due to the pandemic, unfortunately, they will be closing their doors for good on Wednesday. And I know he's having a real rough go of it right now. He started a GoFundMe to try to keep his head above water leading up to the closing, which I'm sure is stressful enough. So if the Sound Off family would like to help him out, and I know some of you did last week, and that was very cool to see, he could use all the support he can get. You can search his first and last name on the GoFundMe website, Micah Harshaw, or you can search for the campaign name. Micah is asking for help. That's M-I-C-A-H. And again, that is on the GoFundMe website. You can search that out. It should come right up. And let's show him some love here heading into the holidays. And shout out to belt fan Brent Banner. His show's been gaining some new followers from our community. I like seeing that. This week on his How Did We Even Get Here podcast, the doctor is in as Trey diagnoses Brent's dating issues. Brent is forced to bask in Trey's glory after a big win. And the boys argue the finer points of Regina King, Nia Long, and Ice Cube versus Tyler Perry. Find the How Did We Even Get Here podcast on all podcast platforms and on YouTube at tinyurl.com/gethere-tube. In the intro to the podcast every week, you hear a maniacal laugh. That laugh belongs to me. And it came after the McMahon family stood in the middle of the ring and announced that they were taking back control of Monday Night Raw. That was 2 years ago this week, almost to the day. The entire McMahon family, Vince McMahon, Stephanie McMahon, Vince's son Paul, Shane McMahon, They all stood shoulder to shoulder in the middle of the ring, and they apologized. Raw had just dropped to the lowest point ratings-wise, audience-wise, in the history of the show. Just over 2.1 million viewers. The show was shit long before that, but that was the breaking point. That was apparently the straw that broke the camel's back. Vince McMahon actually went on live television and admitted, or his daughter did anyway, that they weren't doing a very good job for their audience. And in so many words, they apologized for basically how bad their television show had become. And in storyline, they blamed it on all of these other people. They blamed it on these nameless middle managers behind the scenes. They blamed it on Baron Corbin, which is valid. I'm all for blaming Baron Corbin just, you know, in general. But it's the Vince McMahon modus operandi. It's always someone else's fault. Someone else has to be made the scapegoat. Somebody else has to fall on their sword instead of looking in the mirror and taking responsibility for his own failings. It's just easier to pass the blame on to somebody else. Let's hire Eric Bischoff to be the executive director of SmackDown. Let's fire Eric Bischoff as the executive director of SmackDown. Let's hire Paul Heyman to be the executive director of Monday Night Raw. Let's fire Paul Heyman as the executive director of Monday Night Raw. Bruce Pritchard is still there, but his time will come. His time will come as sure as the sun rises in the morning and the moon comes up at night. We know this to be true. It's only a matter of time. Well, then it must be those damn millennial talents. They don't want it bad enough. Must be their fault. Now we read about there being concern within the company that if things don't improve and things don't shape up soon, members of the creative team could be let go. Some of the writers could be on the chopping block. Ah, yes. Of course. Let's blame the writers. The same writers who we always hear write for an audience of one. That one being Vince McMahon. They write the kind of content and they write the segments and they script the dialogue and do all the things that they think he's going to like. Or they risk, I guess, having their work ripped up, which happens anyway on most weeks. It seems more and more and more often we're hearing about scripts being ripped up and redone an hour or 2 hours before the show. This is all a Vince show. I said 2 years ago, when they announced that Vince McMahon would be making an appearance on Raw to shake things up again, right? He was going to shake things up when the ratings came in. And I said it then, because this is always their response. I'd be shocked if it doesn't happen again this week or next week. Although we're heading into the holidays, so I don't know what their taping schedule is like. But that's always their go-to response when with these ratings catastrophes. Just trot out the McMahons. I said the fans in the building, this is what I said 2 years ago. I said the fans in the building should boo and not bow when Vince McMahon walks to the ring. Because you see them, every time Vince would walk to the ring, he does his little strut down to ringside. You always see those fans in the front row or the first few rows, and they're doing the bowing sign as their show of respect for Vince McMahon. So they bow. They bow to the king. And look, I'm sure some people in the audience are perfectly content. Maybe they're just casual fans, or maybe they just like the show. There are some people who like the show, sure. But you know that there's a lot of people who are doing that bowing, who, as soon as they're done doing that, these are the same people who are going to go jump on social media when the show is over and talk about how boring it was and how much the show sucked. Well, if they really wanted to send a message, the best way you can do that, back when we actually had fans in the buildings and you can actually speak up and cheer and chant and boo, is to do just that. No, what do? They bow. I'll buy towels for the Secret Santa contest so they can make sure they don't hurt their knees when they assume the position. Oh, we were told by Triple H that night 2 years ago, they're going to give the fans what they want. They're going to give us what we want. We're going to give you new faces. We're going to give you fresh matchups. We're going to turn the product around. Remember what he said? We are now the authority. You are the authority. I am the authority. And everybody cheered, yay! We're the authority. It was really, I mean, think about it. It was really quite genius what they did. What they did was they made us the heels. They made us the scapegoats, just like Vince McMahon makes everybody else a scapegoat. He did the same thing to us. Because 2 years later, and things are no better off now than they were then. In fact, they're worse. Much worse. Raw last Monday night set a new all-time record low rating. And I feel like I've said this half a dozen times this year. This is at least the third time that this has happened this year alone. 1.53 million average viewers. For the first time ever, AEW Dynamite, which saw a pretty bad ratings drop of their own this week, topped all 3 hours of Monday Night Raw in viewers 18 to 49 and 18 to 34. What we always hear are the coveted demos. And that wasn't people who were tuned in early and then they just left in droves. These people just didn't tune in at all. They just weren't there. Now, they had a Monday Night Football game on this week. It was a game between the Browns and the Ravens that did very well. But Monday Night Football does well every year. You have your good games, you have your bad games. Raw has been up against Monday Night Football for years and years and years. And see, this is what the bootlickers don't understand. Because I already saw some comments. Well, it was a big Monday Night Football. They got their excuses all lined up. The weather was bad. The weather was good. People didn't want to stay in. We had a good football game. We had this. We had that. They've got their laundry list of excuses. But again, here's what I tell the bootlickers. I can remember hearing about some great Monday Night Football games in past years where Raw did not get its lowest rating of all time. It probably dropped. It probably got hurt. But it wasn't the lowest of all time. And now they're in lowest of all time territory. And that's the difference. And what that shows you is just how much the audience has eroded over the years. You've heard me use this expression before. The lows just keep getting lower. Well, here we are again. The lows keep getting lower. Do you know how hard it had to be for Vince McMahon to swallow his pride 2 years ago and stand in the middle of that ring and basically admit that this show sucks? I doubt it was his idea. He probably had to be talked into it. And still, I had people sending me messages telling me that it really wasn't that bad. People are over-exaggerating. The owner of the team does not hold a press conference to announce that they've let their fans down just because a few people on the internet said so. That's an extreme measure to take. They had enough self-awareness at that time to recognize that there was a problem, and yet they did nothing to try to fix the problem. Trotting out a few new faces is not enough. One of those new faces, by the way, that they trotted out a month later was EC3. How'd that work out? Do we even need to rehash all of that again? You talk about giving new people a chance? Empty promises. That's what we were given. Empty promises. And so now, we get a report from TalkSport that USA Network is said to be furious with the Raw ratings drop, and that they're supposedly pushing for more adult content, not sexy adult, but dark and violent adult, which made me skeptical anyway, reading that. Not that they would be upset. Of course they would be upset. They have a reason to be upset. But that they would be pushing for the darker, more violent, you know, adult-oriented content. I mean, for God's sakes, on Monday night, we just had Randy Orton try to set a man on fire. How much darker can you get? Now Meltzer, I see, is saying that in speaking with people in the company who would know these things, that part of the report is not true. And I see TalkSport has since updated their article to reflect that. He did say USA is almost certainly disappointed in the ratings, and they do make suggestions, but that is not the direction that they've pushed for. So we can set that dark and violent stuff and people getting all excited, the end of PG, it's all nonsense. You can set that aside. And guess what? I don't know what you're getting so excited about anyway, because even if they did that, it ain't going to work. This is what people don't understand. It is not going to work. We may see the McMahons back on TV as soon as this week. And they might even get a little bit of a bounce out of it if they promote it in advance. I mean, you're going to see ebbs and flows in the Raw ratings. The numbers are going to go back up, and then they're going to go back down, and they're going to go up. But the lower they go, the more disappointing those bounces are going to be, because those bounces, they're not going to bounce back to the levels that they were at before. But these are all futile attempts at trying to fix a problem that cannot be fixed. They can call up a couple of new faces from NXT. They could do a big title change on TV. It does not matter. It is a short-term fix. It will not work. I'm not even saying that some of those things aren't good ideas. But do we even have faith in them calling up people from NXT? I almost feel bad wishing for a Rhea Ripley or some of these people to get called up. I almost feel like I'm doing them a disservice by hoping for that. I should be hoping they stay exactly where they are. This year alone, they have been handicapped by a pandemic that has forced them to hold shows in front of no audience. Now, that has also hurt the ratings somewhat, without a doubt. Can't deny that the pandemic has hurt the ratings at least a little bit. Wrestling is a spectator sport. They rely on that instant feedback from the audience, and without it, we're left with the people in charge making decisions about who's over and who's not, and that is a dangerous thing. And I said that from the beginning when they started doing these empty arena shows. They're dealing with that with the circumstances the best they can, but man, this is dangerous. Because instead of relying on you and me and the people in the buildings to see who do we like and who's over and who's not, now it's Vince McMahon and Bruce Pritchard deciding who's over and who's not, what's working and what's not. And, you know, before you could at least judge that based on ticket sales and live events, and they don't even have that anymore. Triple H is already talking about planning big things once they get the green light to move ahead and get people back into the buildings. You know, those first shows back, they're going to load them up. It's going to be like one big party. Hey, I can't wait. I think we're all looking forward to that day. And you know what? They'll probably pop some big ratings for those first few post-pandemic shows. But it's not going to last. This year alone, they have tried new concepts. They tried Raw Underground. Retribution. All of which were blunders. The Raw Underground concept, at least I thought it had potential. But it didn't work. And the fact that Retribution is even still a thing on TV is an embarrassment. So USA Network is disappointed. I mean, don't tell that to the ratings don't matter, folks. I still get messages from them from time to time. It's like whack-a-mole. You knock one out, another one pops up. Don't tell them that. They'll get very upset with you. Here's the truth. USA Network can fuck off because they bear as much responsibility as anyone for the situation that they now find themselves in. It was said to be their idea for Raw to move to 3 hours weekly back in 2012. I doubt anybody in the company was excited about having to produce an extra hour of live TV. That's not an easy thing to do. Their roster was probably already stretched thin as it was, especially if you have injuries and stuff. Now you got to get another hour out of Raw every week. You think they were excited about that? 8 years. It's been 8 years of 3 hour Raws, and WWE has made a lot of money off that third hour. I have seen anywhere from $30 million a year to as much as $50 million a year is what they are supposedly getting for that third hour. Now, I haven't seen the contract. You haven't seen the contract. Nobody seems to know for sure, but they're not doing it for free. So I'm sure they're making some good money on that third hour. But at what cost? You know, in 2012, Raw, I went back to look, Raw was averaging a 3. This week they hit 1.5. They have driven away half their audience. Even if you account for just a general decrease in viewership because of social media and the change in technology, things are different now than they were 8 years ago. Okay, fine, you gotta, you know, it's kind of baked in. You gotta factor that in a little bit, but still, they have driven away half of their audience. That third hour of Raw has been a failure. A creative failure. And moving back to 2 hours doesn't magically make the show better, but you cannot begin to fix Raw until you scale the show back to 2 hours. The show as it currently exists is unwatchable. They used to leave you wanting more. You always want your audience at the end of the night to want more and not less. You want them to tune in next week. Oh my God, I can't wait to tune in and see what's going to happen next week. These people have had 8 years to prove that they can do that, and they have failed. They are simply not capable of writing compelling television to keep people's attention for 3 hours on a weekly basis. And if USA Network is upset, well, excuse me, while I play the world's smallest violin, this is as much their fault as it is WWE's. I could sit here and I can run through all of the ideas that I have pitched over the years, and it wouldn't, and everybody's got their ideas. I've got ideas, you've probably got ideas, but you know, on this show, if you've listened to me for any length of time, you've probably heard these ideas over and over again. None of these ideas on its own are going to make a difference. You know, ending the brand split, it's not going to matter. Doing the top 10 rankings idea for the two world titles and top 5 for all the other belts, it's not going to matter. Less overscripting of the promos, won't matter. Even moving the show, you know, on Monday nights back to 2 hours. You know, bring back Goldberg for a match against Roman Reigns, not going to matter. Firing Bruce Pritchard won't matter. Getting rid of Kevin Dunn won't matter, although it would allow people to watch the show without having to take a fucking pill for motion sickness. So I guess that would be a good thing. Absolutely nothing will change in this company until one thing happens, and one thing only. It is the one thing that needs to happen in order for real change to take place. Without it, all of these other things don't matter. And that is, Vince McMahon must resign as the lead creative force in World Wrestling Entertainment. It seems like, I mean, it seems like an impossible thing to even conceive of. And maybe it is. But you want to know what needs to happen? That's what needs to happen. After nearly 28 years as the showrunner for Monday Night Raw, 21 years for SmackDown, the time has long since come and gone for this guy to step aside and pass the baton to the next person or persons, whoever that may be. I don't know if that's Triple H. I don't know. I mean, it better not be any of the usual yes men. But I don't know if it's Triple H. I don't know if it's somebody else from the outside, somebody else from within the wrestling business, somebody younger from within the company whose name maybe we don't even know. And look, I have to thank Vince McMahon. I got into WWE as a child, and with my friends, you went one of two ways. You either watch wrestling and then grew out of it, as a lot of them did, or you were like me, the raving psychopath I was, and you just get even more obsessed with it, and you get even more into it as you get older. That's the camp that I fell into. And I have a lot of very fond memories from all those many years ago, because of Vince McMahon. And he has built this company, one that was on the brink of bankruptcy in 1997, into a company that is worth billions. They signed a $1 billion contract with Fox. They signed a huge TV rights deal with NBC Universal. And by the way, even when those deals are up in a few years, even if the Raw ratings don't recover, I guarantee you, they are going to get a rights fee increase. So all the people who say, man, the Raw ratings keep going down when these contracts are up, WWE's in a lot of trouble, they're probably going to get a rights fee increase regardless because they produce so much content. Believe me, someone is going to be willing to pay what they want. If it's not Fox or USA, it'll be somebody else. And he built all of that. He oversaw all of that growth. I am not saying that Vince McMahon does not bring value to WWE. I am not saying that he should resign from the entire company. What I'm saying is that the man is 75 years old, overseeing a roster of millennials and Randy Orton. And maybe he just can't relate to them. Right now, he is sabotaging his own product. Vince McMahon has gone from being WWE's greatest asset to being WWE's greatest liability. For the good of the company, he should step aside from all creative matters and focus on being the chairman and all of his other duties on the business end. It's a big company. He's got his hooks into pretty much everything going on. This is just one area that he needs to remove himself from. He needs to completely divorce himself from the process. You know, he told Steve Austin many years ago he didn't think that he was out of touch. People say I'm out of touch. I don't think I'm out of touch. And he said that he was still having fun every day at work. You are out of touch. And you may be having fun every day, but a lot of us are not. Step aside. Get your yes men out of there. And give the fans something to get excited about again. Because until that happens, I promise you, nothing will change. And I'm going to be right back here 2 years from now, giving the same speech all over again. Per the Wrestling Observer, Matt Riddle is set to be close to signing a new deal with WWE. His contract is up in August. The new deal is said to be for 3 years at $400,000 per year, guaranteed, plus $50,000 for every show he works in Saudi Arabia. And it is said that Vince McMahon doesn't get it. He doesn't get the whole bro gimmick. But he finds all of his segments hilarious. I guess Matt Riddle amuses him. They love making all those weed jokes on TV. I'm surprised they didn't offer him 20 grand more on that contract. I noticed, by the way, on Monday night, when he was in the back with Jeff Hardy and... was it Jeff Hardy and New Day? He might have been back there with, I think, all of them. But he was wearing that ring jacket. And I noticed on the ring jacket, it says M. Riddle. Since he has no first name anymore, I'm going to assume that stands for mid-card, unless somebody else has a better explanation for it. But he was in several segments on Raw Monday night, so you know what? I'm sure Vince really does find him amusing. He wouldn't be on TV that often if he didn't. He probably does want him on TV as much as possible. That's $400,000 a year as his downside guarantee, I assume. Not a bad spot for him to be in. The risk, of course, is that he ends up being used for nothing more than just comedy. Having puppets autographing fucking carrots, like he was doing in the back with Ramblin' Rabbit on Monday night. Walking around with boxes of donuts. Matt Riddle may not be a serious guy, but they can make serious money with him. I still believe that. I said that when he was still in NXT, and I still believe it today. But there's also another little cloud hanging over him that has to be acknowledged, which is the lawsuit. Which is the lawsuit that was brought against him, which has still not yet been resolved. It is still out there. It is still pending. It is still hanging over his head. And so the question is, would an AEW, for example, would an AEW be knocking down this guy's door if they knew his contract was coming up and he wanted to play, you know, one side against the other? Which, you know, could be, you got to be careful because sometimes it could blow up in your face. Guys like Randy Orton and AJ Styles, they acknowledge that they used the AEW to get themselves a better deal with WWE. And if you would have asked me this question a year ago, I would have said, are you out of your mind? Of course, AEW would have an interest. They'd be crazy not to. Now, you know what? I'm not so sure. I really am not. I'm not so sure about that. I mean, there's a lot of stories out there about Tessa Blanchard, and AEW and WWE have not touched her yet. Doesn't mean they won't. I still expect her to land somewhere in the not-too-distant future. I think one of them will cave, one of them will want to bring her in, but so far it's been radio silence, and she's, you know, she's a talent, and yet she's been out there, and there's been no movement. So, you know, would they be interested in a guy like Matt Riddle as long as this is hanging over his head? Maybe not. So he's got to look at the situation if you're in his shoes or flip-flops and say, look, I got a wife, I got kids, and I got to make the deal that's best for me. And if that's the role they have carved out for him, well, maybe he feels that's the best move for him to make. Yeah, I know there were a lot of people very upset this week that Shinsuke Nakamura, he lost in 3 minutes on TV to Otis. It wasn't quite a squash, but it was close to it. A lot of people on social media very upset about that. I have long stopped since caring about how they position Nakamura on the main roster. They obviously only have him slotted now at a certain level. He came in, he won the Royal Rumble, he challenged for the WWE title at WrestleMania, had his big feud with AJ Styles. It's not as if they didn't program him in a prominent position at first. I think he even got a win on TV over John Cena. But, as is the case in WWE, not with everybody, but with a lot of people, after a while, they just kind of slot you in at a certain level. AJ Styles has largely been able to avoid that, but that doesn't necessarily work that way with everybody. And I look at Nakamura, and a lot of the stories that you hear about him are that he's content to be here in the States and not go back to Japan and not go back to New Japan, which I'm sure he could do if he wanted to, but he's content to be here because he loves it here, or his family loves it here, and he just loves to surf. So he goes to work, he probably gets paid well, he gets to surf. This guy is living the life. How old is Nakamura? Nakamura's got to be over 40 by now. And think of all the wars that he was in New Japan, and all the abuse, the physical abuse that he probably put his body through. Not probably. The abuse that he did, all those stiff matches, the style that he worked. I wouldn't be surprised if Nakamura looks at WWE as his pension plan. This is like his retirement. He doesn't care. He's living the life. If he's happy, great. He's living the life. He's probably making bank. He gets to surf. Why go back to getting the shit beaten out of him every night? So you know what? If that's the role they have for him, then so be it. It was nice while it lasted. But, let's be honest here. I mean, he was also having matches that frankly were not overly impressive. I can't even put all that on WWE. I aside from maybe the initial match with Sami Zayn in NXT, which, being in the building that night, I mean, it felt like this guy is a big deal. That match had this electric feel in Dallas that night. And you really thought that, okay, they get it with this guy. They gave him the big fancy entrance, or at least Triple H did in NXT. He gets it. And they tried it first on the main roster, but you got to put the blame partially on Nakamura. There were a lot of very uninspired matches that he had. And, if you fall out of favor with certain people and they end up not seeing you at a certain level, it's hard to break out of that. But I don't cry for the guy. If he's happy just surfing and whatever else it is that he does, then hey, enjoy your retirement. But I think there's money to be made with a guy like Matt Riddle who hasn't even reached his full potential yet. Now, is that WWE champion? Is that Universal champion? I think it could be one day, but it doesn't have to be. He doesn't have to be Roman Reigns. He doesn't have to be in the spot that Drew McIntyre is in to, be a big star that can make a lot of money. And, he could be the fun-loving guy, but you got to also make sure that you don't just turn him into a complete punchline. Which, I'm sorry, but that's what R-Truth has become. And I love R-Truth, but they had the opportunity to do some stuff with him too, and once the heel turn was over and the Little Jimmy stuff started, that was it. He's been doing that act now for about 8 or 9 years. That ship has sailed with R-Truth. I don't want to see Riddle, end up in that spot. You could do more with him. There's more potential to do stuff with him. But that's the update. As far as his situation is concerned, it looks like he's probably not going anywhere. Ric Flair appeared on ESPN this week and claimed that WWE is in the process of building a physical Hall of Fame in Orlando. He said that it's been delayed due to COVID. He was on the, I don't know if it was a radio or a TV show, but he was on ESPN to talk about his golden robe. I guess he had a golden ring-worn robe, being the inspiration for NBA star Damian Lillard's new Adidas signature shoe that has either come out or is about to come out. He said WWE had purchased the robe and wants to showcase it in their Hall of Fame. Now, earlier this year, on one of the WWE shareholders' calls, the investor calls, Vince McMahon was asked about a physical Hall of Fame location, and this is what he said. He said, brick and mortar is something that, generally speaking, we are not necessarily fond of, but nonetheless, the interest in that continues to build, and it is still a possibility somewhere down the line. I think that WWF New York scared them off from doing, as he says, brick and mortar. I think it scared them off from doing stuff like that. That, and remember, they also bought a hotel, the old Debbie Reynolds Hotel. They were going to turn that into the WWE Hotel and Casino. I've talked about that on the podcast before. That never happened. That whole project never even got off the ground. Outside of a concept video. If you go on YouTube, you could probably find it. It's like this 3D concept video of what it was going to look like. And it never went anywhere. Although I think they sold the property and actually made a small profit on it. They may have made like $1 million or something on the property. So it ended up being a good deal for them. But again, all their big plans pretty much went up in smoke. They even had a WWE Niagara Falls up in Canada, which was a store. I think they just licensed the WWE name out for it. But that closed down a number of years ago. But I've always said the only way to make this work was to open something in a tourist destination. And Orlando is a tourist destination. You've got Disney World, you've got Universal Studios, maybe even open something up at Universal if they were interested, you know, in working with WWE. Otherwise, I cannot imagine that this would do enough foot traffic to warrant whatever they would have to pay for rent and maintenance. Unless you're a wrestling fan, why would you care? Who would go to the WWE Hall of Fame? You know, are you going to really get enough of those people to justify the operations of the building? You'd have to be a WWE fan or just a wrestling diehard, I think, to probably make something like that work. I mean, I'm a wrestling fan, so I care. I would totally visit if they ever opened up a physical Hall of Fame. Many years ago, at the NBC store in Times Square, Rock Center, Rockefeller Center, they briefly, it was only for maybe a month maybe, when WWE moved back to USA, they were back in business with NBC Universal, they opened up what was basically like a small Hall of Fame on, it was the second or third floor of the NBC store. I still have the pictures I took. And they had a whole bunch of different artifacts in these glass cases. They had the contract for the Hulk Hogan-Vince McMahon match at WrestleMania 19 with Hogan's blood smeared on it and old memorabilia and cardboard cutouts and stuff. And that was just a little section. And I was in like wrestling heaven. I remember walking over there on my lunch break during my lunch break from work. Now imagine a gigantic Hall of Fame. We've seen glimpses of what would be in it because every year they go on the road for WrestleMania fan access. They have all kinds of memorabilia and artifacts and stuff. And, you know, if you're a fan, it's pretty cool. You know, it's pretty cool stuff. Now, WWE has not commented on this publicly, so either Flair spilled the beans when he wasn't supposed to, or, and I think this may be more likely, they bought the robe from Flair for a possible Hall of Fame, right? That's what Flair said. They bought the robe. That's why he made the comment he did. And I think Flair maybe is just assuming that they're opening something up soon. Like when COVID is, the whole COVID thing is over, there's going to be, you know, an announcement made imminently on a Hall of Fame. In reality, though, they may not be any closer now to opening something up than they were before. It could just be the fact that they bought the robe from him. You know, their end goal is to open a Hall of Fame, but we've heard that for years. That doesn't make things any different. We've known that already. And either way, now with COVID, it's going to be a long time before we get a physical WWE Hall of Fame. And according to a story from Nikkei Asia, A man in his 20s from Osaka is likely to be brought up on charges soon for cyberbullying Japanese women's wrestling star Hana Kimura before she took her life earlier this year. The man is suspected by Tokyo police of having cyberbullied Kimura on Twitter by repeatedly leaving anonymous messages such as, "Is there any value to your life?" and "Hey, when are you going to die?" Police confirmed that around 300 hateful messages had been left by 200 other accounts, but they decided that this man needed to be charged with criminal liability as his posts were particularly malicious. Hana was a cast member. I talked about this story back, I guess it would have been back in May. She was a cast member on a reality show in Japan called Terrace House, which has since been canceled because of this. There was an incident on the show that we now find out may have been staged. I mean, it's reality TV. You just have to assume that most things you're seeing are staged or scripted. Either way, there was an incident on the show that took place involving her. She had smacked one of the male cast members who I think had accidentally used a washing machine that had her ring gear in it, unbeknownst to him, and it shrunk, and it was very important to her because that was the ring gear that she had worn at the Tokyo Dome on the Wrestle Kingdom show. And so she had slapped the guy and ran off. I remember watching that scene. I don't know if the scene is still online, but that was the incident that they're talking about. And she faced a lot of backlash for it. She got a lot of negative feedback, a lot of negative comments, people who thought she was, you know, just being mean and nasty and, you know, thinking all, you know, calling her all sorts of names because of what she had done. Now, I think the episode originally aired in March, and she probably got a lot of hate coming out of that, but then it got replayed again in May, and it started all over again, and she was just getting so much abuse that she committed suicide. The suspect told police that he wanted to get back at her after seeing her act violently toward a male cast member on the show. He also sent an apology email to her family in June. He admitted to one charge of public insult, which carries a punishment of being detained for up to 29 days or a fine of at least 1,000 yen, which is equal to $10 US, or of up to no more than 10,000 yen. Police found around 1,200 social media posts, including positive ones, posted by around 600 accounts directed at her. They opened an investigation after her family filed a criminal complaint in late November. The man has since deleted those comments, but police were able to identify him as the poster based on screenshots that Hana had taken on her smartphone. I will never understand what possesses somebody to specifically at someone on social media, whether it's Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and tell them to kill themselves and harass them to that degree. I will never understand that. Outside of just being a troll, in which case, I hope they make an example out of this guy. After doing their best ratings of the year, AEW fell hard this week with just over 800,000 viewers, which actually is probably in line with what they were averaging before, and that is not a terrible number. What makes it look bad is the fact that they dropped almost 200,000 viewers from the week before, and there's no way to spin that number. That's awful. I mean, that's just an awful drop. Down almost 30% in viewers 18 to 49 for what was not a very exciting episode. But it was a productive one in that it focused on featuring newer faces, trying to establish them on TV. There were some, you know, veterans working with the younger guys. Those are not bad things to be doing. But when you have almost an entire show with that, that is not a very exciting show for the average viewer tuned in looking at these guys saying, who the hell is this? And we had another Sting appearance where he came out and said nothing, and I've already talked about that I don't believe that Sting needs to be on the show every single week. I think it's a mistake. It is the law of diminishing returns, and every time he appears and doesn't do anything, that just makes it worse. So they have obviously a story in mind here, whether it's something with him and Darby Allin, or they're holding out the big promo, the big reveal of exactly why he's there and what he plans to do. I'm sure they have a story in mind, but he does not need to be on the show every single week. So I hope they dial it back a little bit, even if it's just a week here, a week there. They've got to dial things a little bit back with Sting. NXT, meanwhile, was way up this week. They were up over 100,000 viewers to 766,000 as compared to the just over 800 that AEW got. Kenny Omega and Don Callis were back together on Impact Wrestling on Tuesday night. And you talk about ratings drops, Impact basically dropped back down to near normal level. They're still a little bit up, but they definitely lost that big Omega bump, that big AEW bump they got the week before. But their next pay-per-view next month is Hard to Kill. And that is going to be headlined by Kenny Omega teaming up with Luke Gallows and Karl Anderson, reuniting with his old Bullet Club buddies to take on the Motor City Machine Guns and the Impact World Champion Rich Swann. This probably is the first step to what will eventually be a one-on-one match between Omega and Swann. And when they get there, you know, is that going to be on an Impact pay-per-view? Is that going to be on an AEW pay-per-view? Because I could see that being the main event of Revolution. In February, if you were to make that champion against champion, winner take all, and Omega walks away with the AEW title and the Impact World title. Because outside of a rematch on that show with Jon Moxley, I don't see there being an obvious main event opponent for Kenny Omega right now. He is going to be defending the championship against Rey Fénix on the final Dynamite of the year, December 30th. That's part one of their New Year's Smash. Rey Fénix was bounced from the world title eliminator tournament a couple of months ago due to injury. He was supposed to wrestle Kenny Omega in the second round. I think it was the second round. And due to an injury, he was taken out. He was replaced by his brother, Pentagon. And Penta and Omega had a tremendous match on TV, but we never got to see Omega and Fénix. And so now we're going to get the match that we did not get to see then. That's coming up not this week, but the following week. At the end of Dynamite, that announcement came after a Kenny Omega win over Joey Janela, who shouldn't be anywhere near even sniffing the AEW World title. But he was in there for a reason, which was to make Omega look strong and dominant, which was the right way to use him on Wednesday night. And the big announcement that was made on Wednesday is that Cody and Brandi Rhodes are expecting their first child, which pretty much puts the kibosh on whatever they had planned or an eventual match with Brandi and Jade Cargill. So there's Shaq having water thrown in his face, being called an overgrown asshole on TV, and it all amounts to nothing because now there can be no match, and I'm okay with that. I'm not complaining, but the timing is unfortunate for them since they started in that direction and now they have to abandon ship. But congrats to the both of them. I feel like we've been hearing a lot about these different baby announcements. I guess there's not much else to do during a pandemic, so I guess we really shouldn't be that surprised. This Wednesday, Dynamite is preempted from its normal time slot due to the NBA. And so Dynamite is going to air on Wednesday. The only question is at what time. Right now they're billing it at 10 p.m. or whenever the NBA game is over. So if the NBA game ends before 10, Dynamite will go on the air. If the NBA game ends after 10, that is when Dynamite will go on the air. And the current card has the Young Bucks defending the AEW Tag Team titles against the Acclaimed, Anthony Bowens and Max Caster, who are still very new. They've been on a win streak on AEW Dark. This is happening, I think, a little too soon. I don't see a title change here. I think I would have just waited a little bit longer and built up to it a little bit more, established these guys on Dynamite a little bit better. Chris Jericho and MJF take on Top Flight. Dustin Rhodes takes on Evil Uno of the Dark Order. Jurassic Express take on Colt Cabana and Dark Order members 5 and 10. How exciting. Pac goes one-on-one with the Butcher, and that is the card as it currently stands. Now, as far as my plans, because usually I go live at 10 p.m. to talk about Dynamite, I'm not going to wait until Dynamite goes on the air at 10 or 11 and then stream when it's over. I'm not doing that. So the current plan, what I'm considering doing, is reviewing NXT instead. I've done that a few times on the channel when Dynamite was preempted. So that is the current plan. I don't know, that could change. So just follow me on Twitter at Solomonster. I'll let you guys know by Wednesday if I'm going live, and if so, exactly what the plan is. But if I'm going live on Wednesday, then I'm most likely talking about NXT. Because I'm not going live at midnight talking about this AEW show when I gotta wake up at 6:30 the next morning. I ain't doing that. But I will probably be on YouTube. Speaking of NXT, Raj Giri of Wrestling Inc. broke the story that Triple H has created a team of people behind the scenes to oversee a brand new NXT show, which would be something of an NXT minor league system. So everybody used to talk about NXT as the minor league, it's developmental. This would be the developmental of developmental. Gabe Sapolsky is said to be leading that new team. Triple H has assigned several agents and several writers to help get him more comfortable writing television. Apparently he has high expectations for Gabe. And, you know, Gabe has been working behind the scenes for NXT for a few years now, even while he was still running Evolve Wrestling. So Triple H is obviously grooming him for bigger things, and this would be the first big project, I guess, for him to really sink his teeth into. And the idea is to create a show that would basically be an NXT for NXT. And there's no word on when it might debut. I mean, I'll just venture a guess and take a wild stab at it here and say that we might see the debut of a new show. Oh, I don't know. Maybe a week before AEW debuts its new show, whenever that may be. I'm sure when that happens, though, Triple H will say it's just a total coincidence. You know, they don't counter program. No. Of course not. They would never do such a thing. Not that the show would be on USA. I mean, I can't imagine USA Network would want the minor leagues of the minor leagues, quote unquote, to be on TV. I assume this would be for the WWE Network. So basically, the way this reads to me, Gabe gets to run Evolve again, only it's not called Evolve. Instead of using the Evolve name, it's a branch of NXT. Yeah, remember, they have so many people working out of the Performance Center who have nowhere to go. They have nowhere to work. They're not on TV, or they're not getting nearly as much TV time on NXT. They're not running local shows in Florida anymore, not since the pandemic started. And it's going to be, if they even go back to doing that, it's going to be a long time before they get back to that. It is NXT overload, but they need a place to work and to establish themselves and kind of get their name out there. But it really is. It feels like NXT overload, right? We have NXT. We have NXT UK. There's expected to be an announcement any week now about the debut next month of NXT India that's about to get going. I've heard Jinder Mahal apparently is going to either be on the roster, at least initially, or have something to do with the launch of NXT India. So that's coming up. As far as this, I doubt I would watch this on a weekly basis. I would pop in and check it out, but I don't think this is the kind of show I would make appointment television for me and review on the show every single week. But look, again, those people need to be doing something. They have to get exposure somehow, because they have stockpiled a whole bunch of people at the PC. They go in and they train, but you've got to have a place to put them. You've got to have a place where they can actually kind of get out there and do their thing. And it sucks because they can't do it in front of people right now, which is what you want to be able to do. But they still need to get out there in some way. And I guess that's what this show would be for. But we'll have to wait and see. No word yet on when it might debut. Cameron Grimes, we're not going to see him for a while. He underwent minor surgery. It is believed to have been, a knee scope. And he's going to be out until late January or early February. Not said to be from any particular match or move, but just an accumulation of time that has gone by, and his knee was in rough shape and he had to go get it taken care of. And that's why they did the injury angle with Timothy Thatcher on TV a week ago. So it's going to be a while before we see Cameron Grimes on television, unfortunately. I thought NXT was a better show than AEW was this week. Objectively, just was a better show. Johnny Gargano and Austin Theory of The Way, that is the name of the new Gargano faction. They beat Kushida and Leon Ruff. There was a scary spot during this match where everybody was outside. Leon Ruff was in the ring and he went to do a springboard dive out over the top rope. And he kind of slipped on the rope as he was coming off. And he crashed and he burned on the ground. And he immediately grabbed his ankle. And thankfully he was okay. One of these weeks, somebody won't be. Thankfully this week it wasn't him. But Austin Theory got the win for his team with his finisher called This Is The Way. And he pinned Leon Ruff for the win. So they kept Kushida away from the losing fall. Even though his team lost, they still protected him. They're protecting him for something. Is it a North American title match with Johnny Gargano? Is it an NXT title match with Finn Balor, which is what I had thought it was? It's got to be one or the other. He keeps winning. Tommaso Ciampa got a win over Tyler Rust, who has been portrayed on TV in recent weeks as a student of Timothy Thatcher's. Ciampa even set a chair up outside the ring and was basically inviting Thatcher to come on out and sit down and watch his match. And eventually Thatcher did come out to observe. And I thought Tyler Rust actually looked pretty good in this match. I'm not at all really familiar with him, but I thought he had a good showing here in this match. They mentioned the fact that he's hardly a rookie. He's had about as much time in the wrestling business as Tommaso Ciampa has. It's only now that he's really getting his first big break. So it's not like he's just some rookie. Ciampa got the win in the end. He hit Widow's Bell, got the win. There was a part in the match, though, where they were outside the ring and Rust accidentally booted his mentor, his teacher, in the face when Ciampa ducked and got out of the way. So we'll see whether or not there's the rift there between Thatcher and Rust, if that's going to continue to be a thing or if he'll break away from him. Thatcher just continues to be made to look very weak on TV. More than I really would like to see him be made to look weak. And I hope, I keep saying fight pit. I want that to be his specialty. You can't do a fight pit match too often, but if this all builds to a fight pit match with him and Ciampa, with Thatcher going over, then it's all good. But even still, I feel like, you know, for a guy with that character, I just feel like they're going a little overboard in making him look very weak on TV. It's kind of surprising. Kyle O'Reilly beat Pete Dunne in a number one contenders match. It will be Kyle O'Reilly getting a rematch with Finn Balor for the NXT Championship at their New Year's Evil show on January 6th. This was an excellent match. Bobby Fish was out there with Roderick Strong in Kyle's corner. Danny Burch and Oney Lorcan were in Pete Dunne's corner, but Killian Dane and Drake Maverick came out. They attacked the tag team champions. Undisputed Era joined in. All of a sudden, here comes Brazongo from out of nowhere. So a giant brawl outside the ring with all the teams, and they fought off, and it was just down to Pete Dunne and Kyle O'Reilly, and they had a tremendous professional wrestling match. Great back-and-forth match, long match, over 20 minutes. With what I felt was a surprising finish. Maybe it wasn't surprising to you, but it was surprising to me, because Kyle O'Reilly got the win. Kyle O'Reilly hit a flying knee drop. So basically, the same move that he won War Games with for his team is the move that he used here to beat Pete Dunne, who is kind of draped over the middle rope, hanging in the ring. Kyle came down with the knee drop and pinned him 1-2-3. I was surprised just because we've already seen the match, and you know, I know he was the one who broke Balor's jaw, and I guess that'll be part of the story going into the match. Is, you know, yeah, you won, but did you really win? Because I put you out of action for all those weeks, and I broke your jaw in two places. So it works. You know, the rematch works. You can get one more match out of it. No, I don't think Kyle O'Reilly is going to become the NXT champion. But because he did lose that first match, I just thought they were building up Pete Dunne, who just came back for what would have been a tremendous match and could still be a tremendous match one-on-one with Finn Balor, but they chose to go with the rematch with O'Reilly instead. And again, that's going to take place on January 6th. But this was a tremendous battle between these two guys. Not so tremendous was the match with Shotzi Blackheart and Indi Hartwell. Indi Hartwell of the way. All of her stable mates were out there outside the ring. Hartwell looked very tentative in the ring. She looked like a student in there, kind of being guided along. Still very green. But Shotzi was arguing with Candice LeRae, who was outside the ring. And Indi Hartwell grabbed the trophy. This is the trophy that was gifted to her by her husband. Had a little troll doll, right, on the top of it. Hartwell grabbed the trophy and she used it to hit Shotzi in the gut with. She broke the trophy, too. I hope she meant to do that. So she got disqualified and they're all beating up on Shotzi and they're holding her for Candice to hit the Wicked Stepsister curb stomp. And she left Shotzi Blackheart for dead. Karrion Kross is back. This was his first match since beating Keith Lee to become NXT champion at TakeOver 30. And Karrion Kross got a quick win here over Desmond Troy. One with the cross jacket choke. He looked dead into the camera when the match was over, and he challenged Damian Priest, who he laid out the week before, to a match January 6th in New Year's Evil. And Scarlett was just... I was so focused on Scarlett. She is a tremendous asset to NXT. They make quite the combo. And Toni Storm in the main event got a win over Rhea Ripley. These are two women who are very familiar with each other. They wrestled multiple times in NXT UK. They had a match earlier this year on the Worlds Collide special. Toni Storm, of course, newly heel. Which is the big difference in dynamic from those earlier matches they had. And Storm pinned Rhea with interference from Raquel Gonzalez. So the issue between Gonzalez and Ripley is not over. I mean, it seemed to me coming out of War Games, they were building to a championship match between Gonzalez and Io Shirai. And I don't know when that match would take place. It has to happen. She pinned the champion. You pin the champion, then you should either be the champion or you should get a title shot next. I don't know if that title match would happen January 6th. I don't know if in the meantime they're going to do another match with her and Ripley and save the title match for the next TakeOver show, which I guess the end of January maybe is when the next TakeOver would be. You're not going to do one in February because that's too close to the WrestleMania weekend one, assuming they do one WrestleMania weekend like they usually do. But I'd look at this and the layout of things, and I would be perfectly fine if the plan here was to get the championship onto Raquel and then have the rematch with Raquel and Rhea be for the championship. These two have worked together before. They had great chemistry together. I think both of these women are two of the stars of the future of that women's division. Rhea is the star. She is the future of that division on the main roster whenever she ends up there. And by all means, take your time. Don't be in any rush to get up there. But I've been very impressed by Raquel Gonzalez. And I think she absolutely has star potential and could be and should be the next NXT Women's Champion. But she interfered in this match and she lawn darted Rhea into the ring post outside, and that allowed Toni Storm to hit the Stormbreaker and get the... Stormbreaker is a very different move. Storm Zero. The old Ahmed Johnson Pearl River Plunge, the double underhook Tiger Suplex, and she got the win. 1 year ago this week, Rhea Ripley defeated Shayna Baszler to become the NXT Women's Champion. She has not had the best of luck in 2020. But, as I said, she and Raquel, these are the stars of the future of that women's division, and... she absolutely is ready to be called up as Rhea to the main roster. I would much rather they put it off. And I felt a little bit differently about it weeks ago. Things have only gotten worse. I have no faith at all. No faith that they would do right by this woman if they called her up today to the main roster. I can only hope. But I feel like it's just kind of pointless to hope for them to do the right thing. So you know what? You got a nice group of women down there in NXT, the strongest women's division probably in any company anywhere in wrestling. Let's keep her down there for a few more months, then by all means. But she is ready to go right now if they want to call her up. This Wednesday is being billed a very Gargano Christmas. And Oney Lorcan and Danny Burch will defend their NXT tag team titles in a street fight against Drake Maverick and Killian Dane. So again, I may be streaming live when that show is over on Wednesday night. Follow me on Twitter. I'll let you guys know what the plan is.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, 57 years ago this week, on December 15th, 1963, Rikki Dozen, widely considered the father of Japanese pro wrestling, died at the age of 39, 1 week after being stabbed in a fight in a nightclub by a member of the Yakuza, or at least a branch of the Yakuza. The father of Japanese wrestling was actually Korean-born. He moved to Japan to become a sumo, and after he retired, he got into pro wrestling. Antonio Inoki, Giant Baba, Hiro Matsuda were all students of his. He was a gigantic cultural icon in Japan, a huge celebrity. Everybody over there at that time knew who Rikki Dozen was. And for all of his success and all of his notoriety, he was also a businessman who got involved with some very shady individuals. And he was also known to be a mean drunk. And boy, did he drink. At the club that night, a young Yakuza member ran into him near the men's room, which led to an argument and the stabbing. The cops were called, and here is a brief court transcript of what happened that night from the book Japan, The Rikki Dozen Years. It says about 11:10 p.m., Rikki Dozen was talking with a club hostess when Murata, which was the guy's last name, when Murata pushed past them, Rikki Dozen said, "Hey, you bastard, you stepped on my foot." Murata denied the charge but admitted, "My shoulder may have touched yours. You're a big man, and it couldn't be helped in such a narrow space." What a polite man. Rikki Dozen, who had been drinking quite heavily, got angry. He shoved Murata, kicked him in the abdomen, and knocked him down. He sat astride the accused and struck him on the head relentlessly. Murata pulled out a mountain knife over 5 inches in length and stabbed Rikki Dozen in the left side of his abdomen. Holding his bleeding belly, Rikki Dozen went up onto the stage and, using the microphone, said, "Ladies and gentlemen, be careful. There's a killer in this club. You'd better go home right away." So he went to go see a surgeon. He didn't really want to draw a lot of attention, though, so he went to an obstetrics and gynecology hospital that was near his home. His wounds were not thought to be life-threatening. He had successful surgery. The problem is that as soon as he got home that same day, he started drinking again, which is not what you're supposed to be doing. And a week later, his condition worsened. He had to go back in for a second operation, which also was a success. But he developed a condition called peritonitis, and he died. 12,000 people. That was the estimate of the number of people that attended his funeral. So when I tell you that he was a huge cultural icon in Japan at that time, I mean, there it is. 12,000. I think if you combine the total number of people that will be at the funeral for every single person listening to this clip right now and forevermore, we will not come close to 12,000 people at any of our funerals. But the man who stabbed him was found guilty of murder. He served 8 years in prison. When he got out, he visited Rikki Dozan's grave every year on the day of his death. And every year before he went to go visit the gravesite, he would call Rikki Dozan's children and apologize for what he had done. And WWE inducted him into the Legacy Wing of their Hall of Fame in 2017. Rikki Dozen was not the only major international star to pass away this week in history. 20 years ago, Lucha Libre legend Blue Demon died of a heart attack on a park bench after his morning training session at 78 years old. So still working out, right up until the very end. 25 years ago this week, on December 17, 1995, WWE presented its fifth In Your House pay-per-view, Season's Beatings. Jeff Jarrett made his return after walking out on the company 5 months earlier, and he announced his plans to enter the 1996 Royal Rumble match, which never happened. Instead, he wrestled Ahmed Johnson on that show. So I don't know what he did to deserve that punishment, but that was his role on the show. And then after that, he was out with a back injury for the rest of the year until he signed with WCW. So he came back to WWE. He literally was back for all of a month, month and a half, and that was it. He didn't wrestle again for WWE until, what was it, the end of 97, beginning of 98? Dean Douglas was scheduled on this night to wrestle Ahmed Johnson, but he claimed a back injury, and that sent WWE scrambling for an opponent at the last minute, which turned out to be the Nature Boy, Buddy Landell. Not that Nature Boy, a different Nature Boy. Buddy Landell, who was basically doing the company a solid by stepping up to do the job, which he did very quickly. It was a quick match. The company was going to reward him by offering him a spot on the roster. Landell was a Ric Flair clone, and I don't say that as an insult, because by all accounts, Buddy Landell was a pretty damn good wrestler. You know, he actually, one of the better matches he ever had was a match that year in the summer of 95. I think it was in Smoky Mountain, against Shawn Michaels for the Intercontinental title. That might have even been the match that really got him on WWE's radar. But he was a Ric Flair clone from the Nature Boy name, which even Flair took. I mean, before Ric Flair, there was Nature Boy Buddy Rogers. So it's not like Ric Flair came up with that name either. But he had the Flair hair, and he wore a robe like Flair. He even used Flair's old WWF theme music. At the TV tapings that followed this show, he had a few matches, including a WWF title match against Bret Hart that he lost. But the next day, so after that taping, there was another one the next day. I don't remember where they were, but wherever they were, there was a blizzard outside. So he had blizzard conditions. He wrestled a young Matt Hardy that night, got a win. And unfortunately for him, as his WWE career was about to really get going, he slipped on a patch of ice leaving the arena that night, and he broke his ankle and had to go have surgery, and he ended up being out for like six or eight weeks. But that was it. He never came back. That was the end of his brief run in WWE until a few years later he had, I don't know if it was a tryout match or what it was, I think on one of the syndicated shows. It's like one match, I think, against Triple H, and that was about it. But Balls Mahoney made his WWE debut on this night, working for Ted DiBiase as the evil Santa Claus. Santa Claus's evil twin, I guess. Santa Claus was from the North Pole, Santa Claus was from the South Pole. And he attacks Savio Vega, who, if I remember correctly, was, I think, giving out, he was reaching into his giant sack and throwing gifts out to the crowd before he was attacked by Santa Claus. Or maybe Santa Claus was giving the gifts out, and then as he went after DiBiase, I think he whacked him with his sack. Something like that. Triple H won an Arkansas Hogped match against the hog farmer himself, Henry O. Godwin, and got his back sliced open pretty good on the gate to the hog pen, which made me wince when the match was over. Because you knew Triple H, right? The pretty boy, preppy boy. He was going to end up in the mud and the slop and the shit. And he did. Got press slammed face down. But then he got body slammed into all that shit and all that mud with an open wound, an open bloody gash on his back. And even then, I remember watching that just going, man, this guy's gonna get infected. Hopefully that didn't happen. Undertaker beat King Mabel in a casket match. This was during his Phantom of the Opera mask phase, after Mabel legitimately crushed his orbital socket. It was not, as I think they told you on TV, because Mabel gave him a leg drop. It was at a live event. They were working together at a live event. I think what happened was he either shot Undertaker into the ropes and he was going for a clothesline, but I think Undertaker was too far away and his fist went right into the Undertaker's eye and crushed his orbital socket. And so Undertaker, when he came back, had to wear this special mask to protect his face. And I always just looked at it and said, I mean, it wasn't really the half mask, but it just, for whatever reason, it reminded me of the Phantom of the Opera. So I always look at that as the Phantom of the Opera phase for the Undertaker. 1995 was a dreadful year for the Undertaker. These were his opponents on pay-per-view. I've made a list. These were his opponents on pay-per-view in 1995. Erwin R. Scheister, King Kong Bundy, Mabel, Kama, who I know is his best friend, so I'm sure he loved working with him. He was on a Survivor Series team against Triple H, Jerry Lawler, Isaac Yankem, and King Mabel. And then a casket match with Mabel. This poor fucker had to work Mabel, what was that, three times on pay-per-view in 95. And he got his face caved in for it. And in the main event, the only thing that really matters on the... Actually, this In Your House was not a terrible show. This was not one of the worst In Your House shows. But this show is really remembered for the main event. And that was Bret Hart retaining the WWF Championship over the British Bulldog in a rematch from their SummerSlam Classic at Wembley Stadium. I like this match better than the Wembley one. I think this is a better match than the one they had at Wembley Stadium. And much bloodier, too. Which is something that was a no-no during that period in WWE. You did not blade. You did not bleed, you did not blade at that time in WWE. And Bret Hart has a history of getting away with this. He got away with it at WrestleMania 8. You weren't allowed to blade then either, and he did. And then Ric Flair did, although Ric Flair didn't really do a very good job of hiding it. And there's the famous story at Mania after that great match with Randy Savage. Flair goes to the back and Vince McMahon was all disappointed and he made some kind of comment to Flair. It was like one step forward, two steps back, or it was something along those lines. He was very disappointed. And he fined Flair for doing that. Bret Hart did not get punished because Bret Hart was able to convince people, even though it was total bullshit, as he admitted in his book. But he convinced everybody that he got busted open in his match with Piper. Hard way. So he didn't get punished. And guess what? He didn't get punished here either. He told the story in his book that on his way to the building, he was trying to come up with something. He and the Bulldog were trying to come up, and really it was Brett, because Brett said the Bulldog basically just let Brett figure everything out. Bulldog was not very helpful in planning for this match. And they were just kind of thrown together. So you have the story of, okay, these two guys are brother-in-law or brothers-in-law. And yes, they had that famous match at SummerSlam, but it was just sort of thrown together. And Brett was trying to come up with a way to really heat the match up. On his way to the building, he claims that as he's driving along, he drove past a pharmacy. He saw a sign for a pharmacy. And so he went in and he bought a razor blade and some scissors. And he cut himself right along the top of his hairline during the match, because there's a spot where Bulldog knocks him into the ring steps. And somewhere in there is where he cut himself. And he made it look like hard way. Even when he got to the back when the match was over, the commission doctor that night, I think they were in Hershey Park, and the commission doctor, when the match was over, said, well, the cut was from the ring steps. And so that was it. Brett didn't get punished. 2 days prior to this show, these two guys had a dry run of their pay-per-view match. 2 days before, they wrestled at the Stu Hart 50th anniversary show up in Calgary. I assume that's 50th anniversary of him becoming a promoter and not his 50th birthday. I think even in 1995, Stu Hart was, he looked like he was 75 years old. But it was some kind of Stu Hart anniversary show. They were wrestling. And Chris Jericho was also, I don't think he was on the card, but he was backstage at the show that night. And Jericho was still pretty new to the business. I mean, he had only been wrestling at that point for about 5 years, right? Debuted in 1990. Had not yet reached the big time. He had not yet, I don't think, had yet appeared in ECW, and he wasn't in WCW, and wasn't in WWE, obviously. But he was there, and as he tells the story, he overheard Brett and Bulldog planning some things out for their In Your House match. And he overheard Brett say that he was having trouble coming up with a finish, because I guess he didn't want to use the sharpshooter, or maybe they told him, no sharpshooter, we don't want Bulldog submitting. Whatever the case, he was having a difficult time trying to come up with a unique finish for the match. I mean, if you think about it, the Wembley match also had a unique pinfall finish. There was no submission. Even the Bulldog didn't use his running power slam. Well, Jericho overheard this. And Jericho suggested using a La Mahistral cradle, which he had learned during his time in Mexico. And Brett had him demonstrate the move for him. And he did. And after that, Jericho really didn't think anything of it until 2 days later when he's watching the pay-per-view. And what does he see? He sees Bret Hart. Not only is he using the move that Jericho showed him 2 days earlier, he wins the fucking match with it. So again, imagine if you're somebody like Chris Jericho, who probably looks up to Bret Hart, you're still brand new to the business. This guy took your suggestion, and that was the finish of a pay-per-view match for the World Championship. And he said he was always amazed that Bret would take a suggestion like that from a rookie. The very next day, Alundra Blaze, who was the reigning WWF Women's Champion at the time, when her contract was allowed to expire 1 week earlier, that was when Vince McMahon made the decision to abandon the women's division, she shocked the world and the WWF when she walked out on WCW Monday Nitro with the women's title and dropped it in a trash can on live TV. This was the second shot fired in the Monday Night War, at least as far as I'm concerned. This was the second shot fired in the Monday Night War. The first one being the shock debut of Lex Luger on the very first episode of Monday Nitro. Luger works a WWF house show one night, shows up at the Mall of America the next. I'd call that pretty shocking. So this was shot number two. She said that she was now going by her old Medusa name. She used to be Alundra Blaze. Now she's Medusa again. She said WCW is where the big boys play, and now it's where the big girls play. Now, there had been plans for an Alundra Blaze title defense at the Royal Rumble in 96 against Aja Kong. They were bringing in some women at that time from Japan. Aja Kong was one of them. And apparently the early plans had that being a match. Aja Kong was probably going to win the title and probably defend it, you know, overseas in Japan. That did not happen. That went out the window when they made the call to just give up on the women. And J.J. Dillon, who was working for Vince McMahon at the time, supposedly either mailed or faxed, probably mailed, a letter over to Alundra Blaze to let her know basically that she was fired. They were not going to renew her contract and that she was fired. She still has a copy of the letter at home. She had not even been fired a full 24 hours when she got a phone call from Eric Bischoff asking if she was interested in coming back to WCW. And of course she said she was, and they had been friends going back to the AWA days, so they had a rapport, and he was like, great. He says, by the way, do you still have that belt? And she said, "What? You know, yeah, I still have it. Why? And Bischoff said, bring it to Nitro on Monday. And then he shared his idea with her about what he wanted her to do. So it was Eric Bischoff's idea. She went along with it. But it was Eric Bischoff's idea. She insisted, though, look, I need to have the belt back when the angle is over because it's not mine. It belongs to Vince. I got to return it to Vince. Bischoff said, sure, no problem. We'll make sure we get it back to you. And they did. After the angle, somebody brought it to her in the locker room, and she got the belt back. I don't know what happened, because she still had possession of the belt, at least up until a few years ago when she went into the Hall of Fame. She still might have it. I don't know if she gave it to WWE. Maybe that'll end up in their eventual physical Hall of Fame. But she ended up keeping the belt. I mean, there's an old tweet from, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. I think she tweeted Beth Phoenix at the time. She was like teasing a match. And it was her at home posing with the title around her waist. So she never did give it back to them. Maybe they didn't want it from her. Maybe they were so pissed at her, they just, you know, basically told her to fuck off. I don't know. But Vince McMahon was said to have learned about the angle from a technician early on during the live Raw show that night. And he was said to be stunned. This was a woman. You gotta remember something here. And she told this story herself. This is a woman who ended up flat broke and homeless. She was homeless for a year. Or the year before she first signed with WWE, she ended up broke and homeless. She was living in her car, and then her car got repossessed. So she was on the street. And she had racked up about $80,000 in debt that she owed to the IRS. And then one day, she got a call from Vince McMahon to see if she was interested in coming to work for the WWF. And he hired her. Now, of course, I hear this story, how one gets a phone call from Vince McMahon when they're living on the street, and this was back during a time with no cell phones. That is a mystery to me. But this is the story that she told JBL on JBL's old Legends with JBL show on the network. So when Vince McMahon asked, you know, look, is there anything you need help with? Do you need help with anything? She said, yeah, you can help me pay this IRS bill. I assume she must have said it, you know, like in a joking or at least a half-joking way. And Vince asked her, okay, well, how much are you in debt for? And she said, you know, $80,000. I don't think she expected anything to come from it. But she says the next day she got a check from Vince McMahon in the amount of $80,000 to pay off her IRS bill. And she repaid him by taking his belt and throwing it in the trash can on a competitor show. So you can see why Vince McMahon would probably keep his guard up and maybe not have as much trust in people as he once did. Remember, the year before this, Randy Savage, in his mind, had betrayed him by walking out and going to WCW. Then something like this happens. That one angle got her blackballed from WWE for the next 20 years until they finally inducted her into their Hall of Fame in 2015. And it probably had a lot to do with that finish to the main event at the Survivor Series in 1997. 23 years ago this week, on December 15th, 1997, Bret Hart, speak of the devil, made his WCW debut on Monday Nitro, 5 weeks removed from one of the most infamous matches in wrestling history. And what was his role? He was announced as the guest referee for the Starrcade match between Eric Bischoff and Larry Zbysko. And referee that match he did. But he also came back out at the end of Starrcade that night, and he ended up punching, it was Nick Patrick, I think, referee Nick Patrick, in the face for what he claimed was a fast 3 count. So Bret comes out, he grabs Nick Patrick. This was after Hogan cleanly pinned Sting with a leg drop. Nick Patrick was supposed to fast count. He didn't. Why he didn't, we'll never know. We can speculate on why. I think we all probably know why. But he did not fast count. Sting looked like an idiot. All this build up for that. But here comes Bret Hart to save the day, and you're just watching this thinking, well, what are you doing? The referee didn't do anything wrong. But Bret Hart says, you know, he had mouthed something to Nick Patrick about, you know, it's not going to be another screw job here or something. Punch the guy in the face. I think Bret Hart was still all amped up after punching Vince McMahon in the face a few weeks earlier. He just wanted to go around punching people. I mean, can you blame him after what happened to him? Some people smash their video game controllers when they get really angry, and Bret Hart goes around punching people in the face. You say tomato, I say tomato. That very same night, over on the USA Network, Vince McMahon announced a major change in WWE's creative direction in a speech on WWE's own YouTube channel that they titled Mr. McMahon Ushers in the Attitude Era. The Attitude Era was already in full effect. It did usher in the Scratch logo, though. This was the first Raw to have the Attitude Era Scratch logo in the corner of the screen. Among the things that Vince talked about was making an effort to entertain us in a more contemporary manner. We in the WWF think that you, the audience, are quite frankly tired of having your intelligence insulted. We also think that you're tired of the same old simplistic theory of good guys versus bad guys. Surely the era of the superhero urging you to say your prayers and take your vitamins is definitely passé. Therefore, we've embarked on a far more innovative and contemporary creative campaign that is far more invigorating and extemporaneous than ever before. He loves using those big words, doesn't he? He sure does. Through some 50 years, the World Wrestling Federation has been an entertainment mainstay here in North America and all over the world. One of the reasons for that longevity is, as the times have changed, so have we. I'm happy to say that this new vibrant creative direction has resulted in a huge increase in television viewership, for which we thank the USA Network and TSN for allowing us to have the creative freedom. Well, if 2020 Vince McMahon would listen to 1997 Vince McMahon, then the product would be better off. That doesn't mean bring back Vince Russo. It means writing television that doesn't drive away viewers and record numbers. WWE insults its audience on a weekly basis, and they should be ashamed of the product that they put on television every Monday night. 21 years ago this week, on December 19th, 1999, the night of Goldberg's fateful mule kick at Starrcade that concussed Bret Hart so badly, it went undiagnosed for weeks and ultimately ended his career. So what WCW tried to do here, what Vince Russo tried to do here, was recreate the Montreal screwjob finish. There's something we've never seen before. With Bret Hart locking Goldberg in the sharpshooter, Roddy Piper, who came down and ended up being the referee for the match, calling for the bell, even though Goldberg obviously did not submit. Bret Hart looked confused, the fans were confused. A lot of people had confused looks on their faces when it came to WCW booking during this period. But the idea, I guess, is that Vince Russo told Piper to give the win to Bret as a way to make up for what happened to him in Montreal. This entire pay-per-view was Russo at his worst. 2.5 years later, Bret was riding his bicycle when he hit a pothole. And he flew over the handlebars and he landed on the back of his head. He suffered a stroke. Did the concussion at this show have anything to do with him having a stroke? When, you know, he had the impact, he had the accident, and did the concussion have anything to do with that? Who knows? I'm not a doctor. I don't know. I don't know if Bret was ever told that it did or not. Maybe he mentioned it in his book. I don't recall. But without that stroke, a lot of things would have turned out very differently. And we probably would have ended up with some great dream matches with Bret back in WWE. I guarantee you he would have been back in WWE a lot sooner than he was. I think a match with Shawn Michaels would have been a given. Imagine that. Imagine being able to build up one last match between Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. You know, some of those legends who were around during the period that Brett was in the mid to late 90s in WWE, Undertaker, Shawn Michaels, people like that. I mean, they, in some cases, had some of the best matches of their career in those later years. Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. You know, the funny thing is, that match they had at WrestleMania 25, which is my favorite Mania match, that's the match that gave Brett the itch to come back and want to work with WWE again. He watched that same match and just thought it was amazing. And that's really where things got going as far as a potential return to WWE, which did happen less than a year later. If Undertaker and Shawn Michaels at that age can go out there in 2009 and have a classic back-to-back at WrestleMania like that, you don't think Bret Hart coming back to the company in 2002, 2003, 2005 couldn't have had some classic matches with Shawn Michaels? I mean, that would have been a given. A match with Kurt Angle or a whole series of matches with Kurt Angle, that would have been a must. Unfortunately, it's one of those what-ifs. 12 years ago this week, on December 14, 2008, Jeff Hardy won his first WWE Championship at Armageddon in a triple threat match against Triple H and Edge. He was originally scheduled to challenge for the title at Survivor Series against Triple H and Vladimir Kozlov. Vladimir Kozlov wrestling for the WWE title. No wonder they wanted to make that a triple threat match and get that third person into that match. That third person turned out to be Edge, after Jeff Hardy in storyline was found passed out in a stairwell. Edge won the title, and a month later, Jeff realized his dream. Jeff Hardy, you know, for people who may have forgotten, or for people who were not fans during that period, I don't think I can adequately explain how popular Jeff Hardy really was for that period of time. I mean, Jeff has always been popular, but there was a period of time in 2007 into the beginning of 2008. And even after he came back from the suspension in 2008, where this guy was red hot. I mean, he was the most over guy in wrestling. I would say comparable even to John Cena. The air was let out of the building inside Madison Square Garden that year at the Royal Rumble when he lost to Randy Orton. Jeff was super over. Now, in hindsight, it's a good thing they didn't put the title on him at the Rumble that night because he ended up getting suspended right before WrestleMania. And that was his second violation of the wellness policy. So he was suspended for 60 days and missed WrestleMania. Now imagine if he was WWE champion. But now here finally at Armageddon at the end of the year, he's the champion. The celebration, though, would be short-lived. It would not last very long because the following month at the Royal Rumble, he dropped the title right back to Edge when his brother, his own flesh and blood, came down during the match. It was a no-DQ match, and he pasted Jeff Hardy in the head with that chair. This was a spot originally reserved for Christian. Christian was making his return to the company. And that was going to be the spot. He was going to interfere. He was going to attack Jeff Hardy, start a feud with him. But then word leaked out online, and Vince McMahon blew a gasket. And so he changed it. He wanted to swerve everybody, and he changed it to Matt Hardy instead. And they sent Christian to ECW Purgatory. The guy didn't do anything wrong. Ends up being sent to ECW. And what a storyline, by the way, this Hardy storyline. What a storyline this turned out to be. With Matt Hardy suggesting that he was the one who burned down Jeff's home the previous year. Which really happened, by the way. That was a real thing that happened. Not Matt burning his home down, I hope. But Jeff's house did burn down. He was living in a trailer at the time. I think it was like a double-wide trailer at the time. This, I believe, was during that period where he was suspended for those 60 days. I think he was out getting a tattoo somewhere. Thankfully, he wasn't home. Might have been an electrical fire. And his trailer burned down along with his dog, Jack. His dog burned up in the fire as well. So WWE, of course, decided to incorporate that into their storyline. So Matt Hardy did not just burn down his brother's home. He killed his dog, too. WWE does not have a very good track record when it comes to pooches. The Islanders kidnapped Matilda. The Big Boss Man turned Al Snow's dog into pepper steak and then fed it to him. Triple H's bulldog, remember that? The build-up to WrestleMania 18. Lucy the Bulldog was run over by a limo on the go-home Raw to WrestleMania. That tells you all you need to know about the way they booked Chris Jericho as the Undisputed Champion. And here Matt Hardy made s'mores out of his brother's dog. 8 years ago this week, on December 16th, 2012, WWE held what I believe is one of the better TLC pay-per-views that they have ever done. And I may be a little bit biased because I was in attendance at this show. The very first WWE pay-per-view ever held at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn, New York. Their first ever pay-per-view at all in Brooklyn. And what would a Brooklyn pay-per-view be without an appearance by the Brooklyn Brawler, who teamed up with Alberto Del Rio and The Miz in a win over 3MB. The Brawler and Heath Slater are the only two wrestlers in that match to not be a world champion in their career. Every other man in that match either was or would go on to be a world champion in WWE. And I think, yeah, I'm not counting Heath Slater if he was a champion in developmental or something. You know what I mean. I'm not counting that. Dolph Ziggler headlined his first WWE pay-per-view and retained his Money in the Bank briefcase in a ladder match against John Cena. Still to this day, one of the biggest matches, I guess, looking back. It was, I don't know if it was the biggest, but one of the biggest matches and nights of his career. AJ Lee skipped on down to the ring and she pushed the ladder over with John Cena on it. She turned heel and aligned herself with Dolph that night, helped him win the match. Excellent match, by the way. But this pay-per-view was all about the Shield. This was the in-ring debut for Seth Rollins, Dean Ambrose, and Roman Reigns in a TLC match against Daniel Bryan, Ryback, and Kane. And I think I had this as my match of the year for 2012. It was either this or the it may have been the Extreme Rules match. Brock Lesnar's first match back against John Cena. But these were the two best matches, in my opinion, the two best matches all year in WWE. And they had some great matches in 2012, but those were my two favorites. This was an outstanding match. And it was a huge win for the Shield. They put the new guys over strong. This is how you get new talent over. I will not ever forget that giant ladder bump that Seth Rollins took during that match. But what a great match this was. 7 years ago, on December 16th, 2013, after 11 years in TNA wrestling, AJ Styles, he was like the Sting of TNA. He was the heart and soul. He was the franchise player of that organization. And he became a free agent when his contract expired. The two sides were negotiating for a while. They were unable to come to a new deal. AJ ended up in Ring of Honor and also signed a deal with New Japan Pro Wrestling the following year, where he immediately joined Bullet Club. And in his very first match, 1 month after he debuted in New Japan, he wrestled Okada and he beat him and he became the IWGP Heavyweight Champion. Now, Styles says the reason he left TNA is because they wanted him to do the same amount of work, but for less money. In an interview with Title Match Wrestling 2 years ago, he suggested that it was at least a 60% pay cut from what he was making previously. He said, "Everybody thinks that we make millions of dollars. That's not how it works." Well, now it is. I mean, I'm sure AJ is making, he's probably making a few million now. Anyway, he says, "Everybody thinks we make millions of dollars. That's not how this works. That's not what we do. You have to pay your agent. You have to pay to be on the road. You've got to pay your taxes. The reality is that it's not as much as people think. I'm not about to take a pay cut after everything that I've done. Because TNA mismanaged their money, I have to pay the price. That's not how it works, and I will not take a backhanded slap like that. And I am still amazed, pleasantly surprised and amazed at the level of success that AJ Styles has had since coming over to WWE. Not that he couldn't have the kinds of matches that we've seen him have. You know the kind of athlete he is. You know what this guy is capable of in the ring. You've had people like The Undertaker turn around and say, man, if I wish you would have been in this company 10 years earlier. You and I could have made a lot of money and had a lot of fun. And you could fantasy book tons of matches if AJ had come to WWE, maybe not even 10 years, but even 5 years earlier than he did. But, you know, at the time, to think that this guy, Mr. TNA, was going to come in and from day one get the kind of big push that he got, it's amazing. Because that didn't happen with a lot of talent that came over from TNA at that time. But from really the first day that he came in, he was treated as an equal. He was treated like a main event player. He got a whole bunch of wins over John Cena. Less than a year later, he was the champion. And 2 years ago this week, on December 18, 2018, I already talked about this earlier in the podcast, but Vince McMahon appeared on Raw with the rest of his family and admitted on live television that they were not doing a very good job for their audience. They admitted basically that their show sucked. They didn't have the courage to actually say it that way and use that word. So I'll use it for them. It sucked. Raw sucked. And they promised changes, not just to Raw, but to SmackDown as well. Because the McMahons are now going to take back control of both shows. It's funny, I never knew they left. I never knew they ceded control. In storyline, they blamed other people for the quality of the shows, including Baron Corbin, which, I mean, they're not wrong. They promised new faces. They promised fresh matchups in the months to come. And Triple H told us, the fans, that we are now the authority. They did that so that they could turn around and blame all of us when the product didn't get any better, which it did not. And here we are 2 years later, with Raw setting new record lows with no end in sight. No matter how many band-aids they put on that gunshot wound, eventually the patient bleeds to death. And that is this week in wrestling history. We got some time for a couple of questions. If you have questions for the mailbag, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Adam from Newport News, Virginia. I just found Gary Hart's audiobook on YouTube, and I am enjoying it very much. It has been widely sought after since it went out of print, so this was like an early Christmas present. Did you ever read his book? Also, who do you think is someone who may write a wrestling book that you would want to read? I have not read Gary Hart's book, and that is in part because it did go out of print some time ago. I've heard good things about it, but no, I have not read it. As far as who might write a book, I don't know who might write a book, but I would say this. If I trusted that he could A, tell the truth, and B, actually would remember specific stories. I mean, I can't imagine all the stories that he must have. I think a Vince McMahon book would be a must read. I don't get the sense that his memory necessarily is as good as someone like The Undertaker. I was pleasantly surprised when The Undertaker started going around doing all these interviews and how much he remembered, like specific stories and events. I don't know what Vince's memory is like. He's also a lot older than The Undertaker. But he's been around for so much, for so long. He's dealt with every possible personality in the wrestling business, promoter-wise, talent-wise, executive-wise, television-wise. If I had faith that A, he would remember, and B, he would actually tell some semblance of the truth instead of his version of the truth, I think that would make for one of the best wrestling books out there. I don't see that happening, though. But I'm trying to think who has not already written a book who I'm just dying to read. You know, the people who I would want to, you know, read their book, I think have already done books. You know, Bret Hart would be high up on my list, and Bret did one of the best wrestling books out there. Yeah, well, all the key players really have, if you think about it, right? Flair did a book. Brett did a book. You know, obviously Jericho did a whole bunch of books, and Foley. I don't know. I don't know that there is that other one person who I'm just dying to read what they have to say. I would have said Undertaker, but Undertaker now has been going around doing all these interviews. I feel like he's already given away most of his stories. I guess maybe Undertaker, if he had more stories to share, that he didn't already share in all the other dozens of interviews that he's done. And Ivan from New York. What happened between Bill Watts and Hank Aaron? Well, nothing really happened between them. What happened is quite the story. So what happened is that Bill Watts had been hired by WCW in 1992. You hear a lot about Mid-South Wrestling back in the 80s and how successful it was. And it was. Bill Watts was a very successful wrestler. And he was a very successful wrestling promoter. And I'm sure that's why WCW at that time felt that this was a good move on their part to bring in Cowboy Bill Watts, and they did, in 1992. And they brought him in also in part because they had to cut costs across the organization. I guess they were bleeding money, they had to cut costs. And so they brought in Bill Watts to run the promotion. And he was also very friendly with the Observer. He was very friendly towards the Torch at that time, and he did an interview with Wade Keller in 1991 that I guess flew under the radar of a lot of the higher-ups at Turner when he was hired, because if they had known that he made comments, or the comments that he did in this interview, I don't think they would have hired him. They talked wrestling, a lot of wrestling talk in the interview, obviously, but then at the very end of this very long interview, the discussion, I don't remember how it happened, if Wade started asking other questions or if Watts just started veering off into other social topics or how they ended up on these subjects. But at the end of the interview, they shifted to discuss his political views and his social views, and things took a very bad turn. I cannot repeat everything that he said. So I went back to reread the exact comments. I can't repeat everything that the man said. But basically, yeah, he was saying, for example, if you own a business, then you should be allowed to discriminate. He said that's why he went into business. He went into business so that he could discriminate. And then he went off on gays. He was throwing slurs around left and right. And why should I have to hire one? They discriminate against us. We should be allowed to do the same thing to them. I have no idea what he was even talking about. And then he went off. After that, he went off on, as he called them, the blacks. Now, consider this. Consider that this is a man who is known in Mid-South for pushing stars like Junkyard Dog before he was ever a star in WWE. Junkyard Dog was a huge star in Mid-South, and could have gone on to be even bigger than he was, but he had drug problems. He had a lot of problems of his own making, and his star burned out relatively quickly after that. That was nobody's fault but his own. But he pushed the Junkyard Dog as a major star. He gave the book to Ernie Ladd. He considered Ernie Ladd one of his best friends. In WCW, he put the world title on Ron Simmons. That was his decision. That came during his tenure in WCW. That great dramatic world title win where he pins Vader and everybody in the crowd is going crazy. And Ron Simmons is the first African-American world champion. It was such a big deal. That came under Cowboy Bill Watts. So, yes, he does have a history of being very favorable to black stars, more than a lot of other promoters did at that time. But he was a businessman. Above and beyond anything else, first and foremost, he was a businessman. And so I think if he thought he could make money off of you or with you, then green was more important to him than black or white. The comments he made here, if you read the whole thing, the comments he made were repulsive. He went off on the TV series Roots and what a fraud it was. And he made a comment, you know, if I don't want to sell fried chicken to blacks, I shouldn't have to. It's my restaurant. Anyway, Bill Watts had a lot of repulsive comments in that interview. And it was one of the reasons that Paul Heyman sued WCW and won. If he won, or if there was a settlement, or what the situation was. He won a lot of money. He won a lot of money, I know that, because he said that Bill Watts would routinely, and at least once this happened in front of a locker room full of people, so it's not just he said, she said. There were other witnesses to this, but he would make comments about Heyman being Jewish, and he would make comments about women, you know, derogatory comments about women, and after he was fired from the company, Heyman sued for wrongful termination, and I think it was either workplace discrimination or ethnic discrimination that he also sued for. Probably a bad idea to even get into this kind of thing with Heyman. His father was a lawyer. I don't quite think WCW knew the tree they were barking up when that happened. But Heyman still says he's not even really allowed to talk about it, even to this day. So we don't have the details on, you know, how much he won or anything like that. I guess there must be some confidentiality clause. But what happened with Hank Aaron, to get back to your original question, this all ties together. What happened with Hank Aaron is Hank Aaron is one of the greatest, for those who don't know, one of the greatest baseball players, legends, to ever play the game. Played for the Braves, still to this day works as an executive for the team. He's been part of the whole, you know, Atlanta family there now for decades. I don't know how much he's actually doing these days. You know, he's 86 years old at this point. But he was working for Turner and had his own office there and everything. And there was a WCW show where he made an appearance. And I don't know what show this was. I don't know if it was just, hey, here's Hank Aaron, and he waved. But there is, you can find pictures online of him in the ring being interviewed, and there's Bill Watts. Bill Watts is in the ring as well. They're all smiles. And Mark Madden at the time, you may know that name. Mark Madden has been a writer for a number of years, and he was working for WCW. You know, in the later years, he was doing commentary for WCW. Mark Madden at the time, not only was he writing for, I think, one of the Philadelphia newspapers, but he was also a writer and a columnist for The Torch. He was working for Wade Keller and The Torch, which is where Bill Watts had given that interview that I just talked about. And so he knew what Watts said. And when he saw Hank Aaron standing with a smile on his face, shoulder to shoulder in the middle of the ring with Bill Watts, he was appalled. And so what did Mark Madden do? Mark Madden faxed a copy of the interview with Bill Watts. He faxed a copy of the interview to Hank Aaron. And when Hank Aaron read those comments that Watts had made, he was rightfully appalled. He didn't even know who Bill Watts was. He didn't know who Bill Watts was. He didn't know that he was working for WCW. He wasn't a fan. He didn't know. I'm sure the day that he was in the ring for WCW, he's probably looking around going, I don't know who these fucking people are. I was just told to be here. But he was appalled by what he read. And he said, look, if this guy works for Turner, then something will be done about it. And the very next day, Bill Watts was gone from WCW. Now, he may have resigned. He may have been fired. I think he claims that he quit. You know, maybe it's the old, you can't fire me, I quit thing. Depends who you believe. But, hey, look, maybe he did. Maybe he did quit on his own. Maybe they met with him about it. They had a meeting. And maybe they wanted him to apologize. And can you picture Bill Watts being the kind of person to go out there and say, oh, I'm sorry? Probably not. So I could easily see a situation where they called him into a meeting and said, you have to do this, you have to say that. And basically he was like, fuck you, I quit. Maybe that's what happened. But that was the end of Bill Watts in WCW. No one will ever dispute his success as a wrestler. Nobody will ever dispute his success as a promoter. And his 1 year in WCW gave Ron Simmons his one and only world title. Some great matches that year in 1992 with Sting and Vader. The Dangerous Alliance. There was a lot of good stuff that year. in WCW. The top rope disqualification rule, that wasn't so good. Him wanting to make wrestling more realistic by having all the mats removed from around the ring, you know, those silly little things that help cushion the blow when you get slammed on the floor, you know, for the safety and welfare of the performers. Yeah, let's get rid of those. He made some pretty boneheaded decisions as well, but it wasn't a bad year for WCW. At least in terms, you know, creatively. Business-wise, maybe it wasn't. I don't have all the numbers in front of me. It's not like WCW was lighting the world on fire in 1992, but then again, neither was WWE. Business-wise, that was a pretty terrible year for them, too. But it was negligence on WCW's part, even hiring him in the first place after he had made those comments. I mean, just from a business point of view, the comments he made, if your choice is to discriminate against an entire group of people, you know what that makes you? That makes you a really shitty business person. That's what it makes you. A smart person would want to serve as many customers as they can. Not a very bright thing for him to say. And yet, that did not stop Vince McMahon from hiring Bill Watts 2 years later to a position of power in WWE. And that didn't last very long either. Follow me on Twitter at Solomonster. As I said, I will be going live tonight on YouTube, the final pay-per-view of the year. TLC, we'll talk all about it, and we'll pick some winners in the Wrestle Rumble Deck the Halls contest. You still have time to enter. $1 for one entry. Had somebody tweet me before. He paid $50. That's 50 entries. And there's still no guarantee that he'll win. But it does increase your chances. So WrestleRumble.com is the place to go to get in on that. I want to thank you all for your continued support. Especially the last week or two, I've gotten some nice little holiday drops from some of you guys, and it's very much appreciated. I'm still trying to put as much work in here as we close out the year as possible. I've been spending a lot of time working on this little year-in-review type video that's going to be going up on the channel probably next week. I'll wait until the final week of the year. Just a little 15-minute thing that'll be going up on the YouTube channel exclusively. Hopefully you guys will enjoy that. So that's just about done, and I will likely be streaming on New Year's Eve. I'll talk more about that next week. We'll have a little New Year's Eve stream going on YouTube, answering your questions and ringing in 2021, putting an end to 2020. So we have a lot of fun things coming up. Be well, stay safe. Have yourselves, if you are celebrating later this week, a very Merry Christmas. And I will be back with you tonight and again on Wednesday night, probably. And back here next Sunday for episode 684. That is going to be the final sound off of the year. 684 episodes. Come celebrate with me next Sunday and keep spreading the word of the sound off. Take care, guys. Merry Christmas.
The Solomonster sounds off.
You mean you don't want to hear Josh Matthews doing commentary?
What is Don Callis doing here? He's got Kenny Omega.
You don't want to hear that for 2 hours?
It's a two-hour show.
Can you imagine me doing an entire podcast in that Josh Matthews voice?
Let's read your super chats. Oz and Glorious.
I don't think I would survive. I'd be spitting up blood before I'm even done recording the full show.
I'm very excited.
Sounds like he has a stick up his ass.
The Solomonster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for sound off extras and more. And follow the Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster sounds off.